Hey, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast. We're just on the cusp of the big March 15th primaries, which could actually decide this whole thing, which I would kind of like because I'd like to do something on spring break other than hunkering down in primary states. Right now, it seems to be that the dominant storyline, sorry, Hillary and Bernie, is Donald Trump, who has decided to wage war with the press. We have a couple of incidents that have occurred. Corey Lewandowski, Trump's crew-cutted campaign manager, a guy who's known to be really combative. He's from Lowell, Massachusetts, so he comes by it honestly. Allegedly, according to a Breitbart News reporter, roughed her up in a media scrum. Any reporter who's ever covered a presidential campaign or a mayoral campaign has actually been kind of roughed up in these scrums. But she claims that it was a real intentional act of violence. And what's fascinating about this is Breitbart News, the right-wing news outlet that she works for, has widely been perceived as being in the tank for Donald Trump. So a lot of conspiracy theories floating around Twitter right now about this. But it illustrates, I think, a fundamental point about the Trump candidacy. He is beating up on the very people who have made him who he is. That's the paradox. So Donald Trump, you go to his rallies as a reporter, you are penned into what looks like a chicken coop. You have to stay as a reporter in this very small area. He berates you, sometimes by name. Reporters have said they feel this latent sense of violence. The crowd boos at them like they're at a hockey rink. And on the other hand, he's unavoidable for comment. That's what they used to say about Ed Koch. The guy is extremely accessible, and he runs hot and cold with reporters. He'll be very accessible to somebody who a couple of weeks earlier he had said he'd never talk to. So Trump is a bullying, accessible candidate. I've covered Hillary Clinton for a long time. Her staff, her press staff, you know, people talk about how nasty they were in 2008. Nobody ever came after me physically. This time around, they're extremely polite. We know a lot of these folks, yet they offer very little access to the candidate. She didn't have a press conference, for instance, for something like 81 or 83 days, and only then kind of allowed reporters to shout questions about a week ago. So that's the Trump paradox. He is accessible, but bullying. And Hillary Clinton, his likely opponent in November, is somebody who is inaccessible and painfully polite. Welcome to 2016, folks. I'd like to do a little business before we get to our guest, Joel Benenson, the chief strategist and top pollster for Hillary Clinton, played the pollster role for the two Obama reelection campaign. Joel is somebody I've known for a while. And he's a good bookend to our conversation last week with Tad Devine, who is the chief strategist for the Sanders campaign. But first, like I said, a little bit of business. Please follow us on iTunes and rate us. And if anybody has any suggestions for guests, comments, criticism, unabashed praise, gifts, I always take gifts. I'm joking about that. Send an email to me at gthrush at politico.com. All right, so Joel Benenson. Really interesting guy. Queens guy, started off his life in the 1970s, had a bunch of jobs, worked for a beer distributorship, dabbled around, believe it or not, in off-Broadway theater, became a reporter at the New York Daily News, which is where I first came across him, and then embarked on this fourth career, I guess you'd say, fourth or fifth career as a political pollster working in a lot of local races. That's how all of us New York reporters really got to know him. And then in 2008 became the pollster of pollsters for the Obama campaign and really made his reputation and cemented it in 2012. This time around, it's been a little rockier, as Politico's reported. Joel is not generally considered to be a Clinton insider, but he's developing a good relationship with the campaign. He was instrumental, I think, in developing some of these messages that really carried her through Super Tuesday and helped her succeed in South Carolina. So we're going to have a pretty interesting talk about the road ahead. Without any further ado, here's Joel Benenson. We sit here on the eve of the March 15th primaries. We're guessing they'll be decisive on the Republican side, maybe a little less decisive on the Democratic side. Does Bernie Sanders have any chance of winning the Democratic nomination?
I think you take it one, election day at a time here with these primaries. I think any night where we or day where we come out with more net delegates than he does is a good night for us and a bad night for him. That's happened pretty much on every night so far, including last Tuesday. That, as I've always said, delegates are the currency of the nomination. You have to win more delegates than your opponent. We're winning more votes than Bernie Sanders by 1.6 million so far, and winning delegates, pledged delegates in particular, by a significant amount.
Does he? But come on, I covered you in 2008, 2012. You did that roadshow. You would go to all the newsrooms, right? You and Mitch, in the general, in 2012, and you'd be like, Mitt Romney stands no statistical chance of being elected president of the United States. Come on, do this with Bernie.
Well, that was in October, too. I mean, look, this far out, I mean, we think we have an advantage. We are winning more states. We are massively winning more votes. And we have a pledged delegate lead now that is in excess of 200. And I'm talking just pledged delegates, right, not super delegates. We have a bigger lead in pledged delegates than Barack Obama had at any point during his campaign with Hillary Clinton in 2008. The reason why I say it's important, the math is still the math. It just gets harder each day when you lose a lot of real estate because a lot of delegates. Tuesday, over 800 pledged delegates get decided. We come out more net plus delegates on Tuesday. He just has less territory to gobble up to try to catch up. It gets harder each time. That's why I say any night where we get more pledged delegates than he does is a good night for us and a bad night for him, because he has less opportunity to make up that ground.
Let me attack this from the other side then.
But I don't have a date certain where you can say he can't make it up yet. It gets harder. There was an article written today about it. The percentage of how many of the remaining delegates he has to win just continues to increase, where the opportunity.
What are the numbers as we stand now? It's at 60% roughly?
No, it's a little less than that. I think it's about it's in the mid-50s right now. He'd have to win, but depending on the outcome Tuesday, if we win the number of net delegates we anticipate winning, it'll go up closer to 60%. That's a hard thing to do.
Why'd you lose Michigan?
You know, everybody asks why we lost Michigan. Michigan was a close race. We had it a close race from the start.
What were your you don't tend to share this stuff, but give me a sense.
I said to
people
when they asked me before, we tended to be in the kind of low to mid single digit range,
right?
Which meant it was going to be very close. I think he did a very good job in Michigan of turning out 18 to 29 year olds. He's had the highest percentage in that electorate of 18 to 29 year olds I think we've had in any state.
And you're modeling.
And he won them by a big margin. Hillary Clinton still won all voters over 30 in Michigan, but not by enough to counteract that one group that he turned out very well in that state. Listen,
they were shot. By the way, their internals, you know, it's funny. I talked to Devine and he said it on the podcast that their internals were showing much better than the 17% poll average than the public polling.
Much closer. So were ours.
Yeah.
I mean, I anybody who was asking me, I said, no, we think this is still going to be close. It's not a, this is not a big blowout win. This is going to be a tight race.
What got the turnout going with the kids? Was it the back against the wall phenomenon? The fact that this was his last stand?
No, I don't know. Every state's a little bit different. I think, we're talking about this as, you know, some indicator of anything else in the campaign. It's not. It's one state. We've got to go, as I said on each night, win more delegates, which we did that night. In fact, to me, the irony is all night long watching cable and the stations covering it, it was a close race, you know, all the way up till midnight or so when it was called. They're saying, you know, no matter what happens in Michigan, this is going to be a good night for Hillary Clinton because she is going to net many more delegates than Bernie Sanders. And we did. I think we netted 17 or 18 on the night, more than Bernie Sanders. So,
but turnout in Wayne was not what it could have been. And your percentages in Wayne being Detroit, for those folks.
Wayne County.
Yeah. Why do you think it seemed like the generational split that everyone had been hypothesizing about in South Carolina finally materialized in Michigan? But why do you think the enthusiasm level in a place like Detroit, where she really laid it on the line in Michigan, she was there a lot. Why do you think she couldn't quite get them out?
You know, I just have to come back to this. Look, we came up short by 17 or 18,000 votes out of a million votes, right? Like, if we had gotten 18,000 more votes out of Detroit, just done a little better out of Wayne County, we wouldn't be having this conversation, and the delegate math wouldn't be materially different.
Yeah, and if I had,
and we're going to five states on Tuesday.
And if I had hair, I wouldn't be wearing a hat.
Yeah, well, you're not wearing a hat right now. For those who can see,
I will put it on.
Which are me and Bridget. You know,
no, but come on. Like, did you? Okay, let me just ask you.
No, here's the problem.
Wait, did you underperform?
No, here is the problem. You are obsessing about Michigan. We have talked about Michigan now for 5 minutes.
Okay,
we are ahead by over 200 pledged delegates, and we have five states on Tuesday where I believe we will expand our pledged delegate lead again.
You don't have to yell at me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just
so wait. No, so are you saying unequivocally that you think you're gonna emerge from Tuesday night with a substantial advantage
as I said, I think we are going to net more pledged delegates on Tuesday night, and anytime we do that, that is a good night for us. Substantial. There are a lot of delegates. Like I said, if there are 867 out there, I don't know how we'll be measuring substantial by the end of the night, and I can't forecast it because some of these states are closer than others, and you know he's competing. He just put a lot of money on the air, including breaking his pledge and running negative ads for the first time, where he's calling her out specifically. A Washington Post article broke shortly before we started talking here. They clearly, you know, think they need to do something. Otherwise, I'm sure this candidate who's prided himself on this pledge wouldn't be breaking it the way he is at the last minute.
Do you think he's running? You know, I get emails from Brooklyn all the time, sort of talking about Jeff Weaver with the DNC breach. Do you think the impression generally that Sanders is running a very white gloved candidacy is overstated? Do you think he is a...
Well, completely. I mean, of course it is. He's been in the free media, leveling very explicit attacks on Secretary Clinton. He's tried to impugn her character. He does it all the time. He does it, you know, in a way that has given him enough wiggle room to say, no, I'm not being negative. But of course he is. His whole campaign. Look, he's been attacking, I think the point she made in the debate on Sunday night, he has spent all of his time here attacking Democratic presidents who have done enormously good jobs in rebuilding the country after Republican devastation. You know, 35 years in Congress, I haven't heard him in this campaign, he's now been here almost 12 months, go after a single Republican as hard as he's running against and the harshest he's the things he said about the president who was president in the 90s. And the things he says about Barack Obama.
He thinks
by now he says, oh, Barack Obama's a friend of mine. You know, I like to remind everybody what he said when Barack Obama was under attack by Republicans running for re-election in 2012, when he called him weak, a disappointment to millions of people, and said he didn't have the backbone to stand up to Republicans. You know,
you were with Obama around that time. How did Obama personally respond to Sanders' attack?
I think it's been reported people in the Obama campaign saw it for what it was. I think most Democrats should know what he said about that. But there's a larger point here.
No, but
not running about 2012 or the 1990s. But the point here is he continues to indict highly successful with his overheated language, highly successful Democratic administrations who rescued the country's economy twice.
And this seems to personally...
Haven't heard him say a word about George Bush. Have you even heard him mention George Bush's name on the campaign trail?
Not that I can recall.
Yeah, exactly.
Does it piss you off personally as somebody who worked on the 08 and 2012 campaign? Did it piss you off at the time?
No. It was May 2011 when he made those comments. He, you know, says he endorsed them. He waited another year to endorse them after he made those comments. But it actually pisses me off more now because it's disingenuous. Don't stand on a stage in front of television cameras with millions of people when you're running in a Democratic primary and say he's a friend of yours and you work with him. Yeah. You know,
do you think Obama views him as a friend?
I don't know. I don't speak for the president. You know that. I have no idea. I've never talked to him about it. I don't remember being in a conversation with him in 2011 about it.
So Bernie wasn't really.
I don't believe there are Democrats in this party who believe Bernie Sanders' assessment of Barack Obama. And he leveled it at a time when the president was under attack from the very Republicans that Senator Sanders seems unwilling to attack about what's wrong with the American economy.
Do you consider Bernie Sanders to be a capital D Democrat?
You know, look, he's a progressive. There's no question. He calls himself a democratic socialist. I'm not sure what that label means. This is the first time I believe he's run as a Democrat. He's caucused with Democrats. There's no question that we're more aligned on issues, and he's more aligned on issues with Democrats than he's been. I don't know why he finds it so odious to call himself a Democrat. He's got to answer that. It's the party of working people. It's the party who's actually gotten things done in these fights, who have, you know, really reversed the worst of trickle-down economics. And I don't think he's been a leader in those efforts. I think he's been aligned with them. But, you know, over his 30-year record in Congress, you know, he's not a newcomer to these fights. You know, he says no one has stood up for him against the special interests. I don't know what the results are that he's brought to the table after 30 years in public life. I think, as Hillary Clinton says, she's a progressive who gets things done.
Well, the one thing I will say, though, you know, that debate in Miami was, I thought, fascinating for a couple of reasons. I thought they were both brought their A game. I thought she was very good. But I thought one thing you really saw about Sanders, and it's funny, I was on a panel with Howard Dean yesterday, and Dean was talking to me about how Bernie Sanders is one of the best pure politicians he's ever met, right? And the way, Sanders doesn't look like a politician, he doesn't talk like a politician, he talks like you and me, which is bad, right?
No, talking like, other than the accents we carry
who
with us,
wants this?
The Queens Brooklyn accents, it's actually not bad, he talks.
But the point that Dean made, and the point that I did a takeaways on this, I think he is an exceptionally smooth, almost slick politician. I mean, and I think he is, in terms of his presentation and his capacity to carry a message in a disciplined way, is her superior as a politician. I mean, do you think that he is a better politician than your candidate?
No, I don't think he's a better politician. I think, you know, you're talking about certain skills he has on the stump. I think, you know, she said in the debate the other night, you know, I'm not the kind of natural politician that, you know, Bill Clinton is or Barack Obama is.
But you have a policy book.
She is a skilled politician when it comes to getting things done that make a difference in people's lives. I'll take that any day.
Okay, but messaging him is really simple. You know, the other thing that Dean said, Barney Frank says it all the time, the guy's given the same speech for 40 years. And it's a really succinct, I mean, if there's a commonality between him and Trump, apart from sort of tapping the anxiety and anger, it's the simplicity and compactness of the message. Now, you may quibble with sort of the content. She's a policy book candidate. And compressing all these disparate things that she has done strikes me as being an enormous challenge, as opposed to Sanders, who's able to sort of microfocus. Talk to me about the challenge, because clearly you guys have had messaging issues and you've talked about this. The challenge of taking somebody who's had such a multiplicity of careers, who has a complex message based on competence, versus somebody who's hammering one nail.
Well, it poses some challenges, but I would say, just as a reminder, that we've got 1.5 million more people voting for us than he does. In fact, there are three candidates who have more people voting for them than in him. We're the only one who has nobody in the field who's gotten more votes than us.
Right.
He's got both Trump and Cruz who've actually outpolled him. I think actually it becomes an advantage. The consistency and the limited nature of his message. He's very good at indicting the system. What he really hasn't been able to tell people is what he's going to do about them that's going to make their lives better. His plans have been questioned by experts and voters as being kind of not adding up. Either he can't get this stuff done, or the numbers just don't add up. Is this going to cost me more than I'm going to get? Those are real doubts people have. There's a reason why we have won 1.5 million more votes than he has so far, because we have actually addressed the broad concerns. We have talked about breaking down all the barriers and building ladders of opportunity so everybody can live up to their potential. He's very good and very disciplined. As you mentioned, they said he's been giving the same speech for 40 years, but it's all a critique. He doesn't have the breadth and depth of plans that are really resonating with people and saying, wow, this stuff can get done and will make a difference in my life.
I know you don't want to. I've tried 4 or 5 times to get you to talk about the different races that you've worked on. But I do think, and having covered you in 08 and to a greater extent in 2012, I kind of got to know how you, you know, how you approached your job. I just want to ask you in a general sense, this is a Joel Benenson, the person question.
Yeah.
What's it like? What is it like? And let's come, because I think this race is a lot more like 2012 than it is like 2008 to some extent, right? Do you kind of agree with that as a premise or?
A lot
more like that this is a much more 2012 environment than a 2008 environment, even though there is,
I would say more so because the crisis happens in '08 and we are still dealing with the, you know, economic aftershocks of that, notwithstanding the progress we've made in the 8 years. So,
but whereas
we were still very focused on the cost of the Iraq war, right, war in 2008 and '07, but the cost of it was part of the economic crunch that people were feeling. But sure, right, go ahead.
But in general, and let me pick one of them. Let me pick 2012. How is the environment, like, how is your job different in terms of looking at this electorate between, even as recently as 2012? What's different about, Manish Tanah Halayla Hazeh, what is different about this election than 2012?
Well, I mean, first of all, in 2012, you have the incumbent running.
Right. But I mean, what I'm talking about is sort of the atmospherics, the feeling of the electorate, both on the primary level and the general level.
Well, first of all, we haven't spent a whole lot of time on the general electorate because we're in the primary. So we've done just a little of that, which you always do at the outset of a campaign to make sure you've got, you know, a path there as well. Look, I think where most Americans are today is in a different place from 2012. I think they felt a lot less stable, less stability in their lives. I think they were still fighting their way back, more economic anxiety at that moment, very heightened concern about what the Republican economic policies would mean to them. I think today, 4 years later, there's a bigger dimension out there. I think people economically feel, okay, I've gotten back a sense of stability. I haven't gotten back all the security I had once before. Right. They're finding ways to make it work. Those things are still hardships in some ways, you know, working two jobs or working two shifts or, you know, a dad taking the kids away on vacation while the mom stays home to work her second job because she can't get time off from it. You know, they're finding accommodations to make. I think they still worry about not having a little extra money if the roof leaks, you know, or, you know, you get a flat tire in the car, things like that.
But there's not that anger on the Democratic side that you're seeing on the Republican side, right?
But look, the Republicans have had anger for a long time. It happens to be aimed at Democrats, and their economic remedies and their social remedies are wrong. In fact, one of your colleagues sent me an article that was put out by Politico shortly after the 2012 election, which I had forgotten about, although it reminded me, where I said, you know, if the Republican Party thinks their only problem they have to fix is with Latino voters, they're missing by a mile.
Right.
Because they have become the party of intolerance, and that's what's different from 12 in a way. It's been exacerbated now. They are both out of touch when it comes to the economic policies, which voters you need to win a presidential election in America reject. And every one of them have continued to double down on very much top-down economics, give more to the wealthy, give more to corporations. That is still anathema to the working middle-of-the-road voters that you have to win in a presidential election.
Yeah.
Compounded by a campaign on their part that is reinforcing a party that looks very out of date and out of touch when it comes to social issues, when it comes to where America is through the intolerance we're seeing, the bigotry we're hearing from the stage in many of these campaigns, and they're all reinforcing it.
But circling back, you said that you said something really fascinating, because I think like the script on 2016 is that we're reaching kind of the apex of anger and anxiety. But you're telling me that at least, and I presume you're talking about the Democratic electorate, that you're seeing somewhat less, it's become a more of a hardened thing. But again, just sort of, now you got us, you know, you're obviously looking at different demographic groups and different age groups.
Well, can I interject something though on this point?
Yeah.
You know, a couple of people, Wall Street Journal put something out, I think 538.com or The Upshot did one. You got to differentiate between general electorate and the Republican Party. The dissatisfaction levels with Republican candidates among Republicans is the highest it's ever been in history. Like, that party is going through a fracture right now that every day this goes on, you know, their angry, loud voices are not winning them support even in their own party, frankly, right now. And it's a real, it's beyond an identity crisis. When you have 52% of your people in your party would not be satisfied with any one of your leading candidates for president.
And comparably, what's the number on the Democratic side?
That are satisfied?
Yeah.
Oh, 77%.
Is that your biggest advantage going in? Do you think, looking at 2012, you know, there was a fight in 2012. I mean, do you just think that any Democrat at this point in time has an advantage, a big advantage in the general election over any Republican?
Well, I've said repeatedly, I said it yesterday to a group I was speaking with, you know, we have certain structural advantages right now, but they're not just because of party politics, they're because of what each party stands for. So when I talk about this, I don't want you to think I'm just talking in terms of partisanship, because we still have to win swing voters. But the structural advantages, because of a Democratic Party that is the party of fighting for working people, and the Republican Party being kind of out of touch and out of date right now, has set up a basic dynamic that gives us a big structural advantage in the Electoral College in a general election. If you look at the states that Democrats have won in 6 out of the last 6 presidentials, or 5 out of the last 6, it adds up to 257 electoral votes. It means you only need 13 more to get to 270 if we perform that way.
Trump says he can beat her in New York. He says he can beat her in Pennsylvania. Think he's got any justification for saying
no,
that?
No, but he doesn't. His whole campaign, he doesn't have justifications for saying a lot of what he says. So, I mean, you know, this is a guy who can say anything, and he got a lot of bluster.
But you think it's just, you think his electoral path stuff is bullshit?
Do you think President of Mexico is going to pay for his wall?
Maybe he'll pay for his path. Okay, so let's look at your demographics. These numbers on, and don't give me your usual spiel on this. These numbers on youth voters suck. They're bad for her. I've been talking, this is what I said to Ted. I've been talking, when I talk to people on Background and Off the Record on your side, people will flippantly say the youth voter plan in the general election is to get Bernie Sanders. How does she start attacking that issue, and why do you think she has a problem in the first place?
Look, I think you've got, you know, you're in a competitive race, and you know, you don't want me to give the normal answer, and I won't, but just jog your memory a bit. There was a lot of this back and forth over 2008 over, well, how do you get these voters? You're not winning in primaries. You've got to remember that the general election becomes its own gravitational force, if you will,
pulling in
a direction. But you can't take that for granted. I think what you have to do is you can't stop communicating and talking with groups that you're not performing as well with in minorities. You know,
but what's the why on this?
Now, well, wait a second, though. But let me ask you a question. Why isn't Bernie Sanders doing better with voters over? Why is he losing voters over 30 in every state?
Well, I've written about that. I've also written about his underperformance with African American
voters.
Why
is he? Is anybody saying to him, what do you do, Bernie, to win voters over 30 in a general election? How are you going to do it? You've lost them by almost, you know, 20 points in most of these states.
If I had him sitting across from me, I would ask him that
question.
Well,
you should. You didn't ask Tad that question.
I did not ask Tad that question.
I mean, that's my point.
A Shonda.
You know, look, I'll answer any questions.
Yes.
Look,
but tell me why do you think? Stop for a second. Tell me why. And
he has built his campaign around it.
Okay,
he has used that to galvanize a core base of people because he is not penetrating in other groups. They knew it from the outset that they had a build there.
But what is
They've
it about?
Done a very
what is
good
it,
job.
What now? You but this was the but you capitalized as Obama's pollster and as a strategist in 08, you capitalized on that same gap. And so you were attacking the problem from both sides. What do you think it is about her? I'm going to corner you on this, and you're going to yell at
no,
me.
No, I'm going to tell you the question for Bernie Sanders is that the candidate in this race who has most replicated the Obama coalition happens to be Hillary Clinton. Now, you guys can ask all you want about any demographic group, but the truth is he's got more gaps in terms of the Obama coalition than Obama had, than Hillary Clinton has versus the Obama Clinton.
But he does have the youth.
Coalition. Barack Obama, he has the youth, but frankly, he doesn't have voters between the age of 30 and 50. He doesn't have as many women as generally as Obama has had in the primaries. You know, I think you have to look at the totality of things, not just the moment we're in. And the truth is, the strength he has largely been among his young voters. And to a credit, he has excited them. He's got
them. It gets back to the simplicity and maybe just the pure aspirational aspect of it, where she's an explainer
I don't know. I think he's trying to rally them to take on the system. You know that. You know, maybe that has some appeal for them right now. I don't know. I mean, you look at movements like Occupy Wall Street, which never really rivaled the Tea Party right. movement. So, you know there is a big difference there between what's happening on the right and the left. We have to keep communicating with young people. We think our message about the future is actually stronger. I think we talk to them more about jobs, more about reducing student debt, more about getting the costs of health care down, more about educating their children when they become parents than Bernie Sanders does. We have a much stronger, fuller, future-oriented agenda to talk to the millennial generation, people between 18 and 34. And we got to keep communicating it and communicate it more clearly because this election is about their future.
Now, so you would talk about swing voters, right? For years and years and years, I was educated by you and other folks in the Obama campaign that swing voters, while they were important, were not as important as sort of base turnout, right? There was always that sort of that dynamic argument. Do you think swing voters, given the fact that so many independents are, you know, the open primaries phenomenon, how many independents are sort of flocking to both Sanders and to Trump? Do you feel that we're entering an age now where we're getting back into that swing paradigm, where you're starting to aim at the middle a little bit more?
I think it's a little, and I might be in the minority of those folks who worked in the Obama campaigns. I can assure you that we spent an awful lot of time persuading swing voters that our concentration, you know, the polling we do in general elections is concentrated in battleground states. Right. Now, you can add some battleground states as you go forward here, and we may do that because I think if Trump is the ultimate nominee or Cruz is the ultimate nominee, there are going to be some states that have been a little more red than swing that will be put into
which
play.
Which ones?
Arizona, I think, in particular, is one where I think because of some of the hardline rhetoric could happen. North Carolina has traditionally been part of the battleground state, but that's a state that President Obama won in 2008, lost by 2 points in...
won by, what, 13,000, 14,000 votes?
Lost it by 2 points in 2012. I think that's going to be a very problematic state for Republicans. Now, we played there in 2012, but not a lot. Obama president didn't go into the state. We let Romney outspend us 5-1. But no, I think swing voters are, look, you have to get swing voters because if you basically start out here as kind of a 43-43 country, maybe now Democrats have a little more advantage, 43-40. I think you do have to persuade enough swing voters, particularly in those battleground states, to get to your side. Some of them are Democratic-leaning independents. Some are in this election are going to be Republican-leaning independents. But I think you have to do some persuasion, but then you do have to turn out your voters.
Right.
So I don't think we're getting into a world of just base voters. We're getting into more sophisticated techniques to identify the swing voters that you can persuade and then turn out. You have to communicate with them earlier.
Well, it's one of the things Pluff said to me was like, the one thing he misses about this stuff is not the churn and the bullshit, is getting his hands on the new toys, right?
Well, he can come back in and play anytime he wants, can he? I mean, no one would say no to having him. But that's true. I mean, this stuff is evolving pretty quickly. And I think that's where, and I'm sure David would agree with this too, that those tools allow you to identify your swing voters better.
Well, let's talk Trump.
And then get them to vote.
Let's talk Trump map for a second. I know you don't want to look ahead, but clearly, come on, you clearly have that out of the corner of your eye. Is there any state where Trump threatens her more than Romney threatened Obama? Is the Trump map, how different is the Trump map from the Romney map of 2012?
Not having looked at it state by state, I don't see any state that Democrats have won 5 out of 6 times that Trump, at face value poses a threat in. I just don't see.
Are there any states where Romney was? Let's look at Colorado and Iowa and Nevada for a moment. Those three states where Romney was, you know, pretty competitive. He obviously had a regional connection there. Is Trump just naturally disadvantaged in that Western tier?
I think it'll remain to be seen. I don't know that if he's naturally disadvantaged. I mean, you mentioned Colorado and Nevada. you know, again, haven't looked at any of these states in a general election context yet. Obviously, they are two states that have a significant population of people of color, African-Americans and Latinos in both states. Both of those states have shown consistent voting patterns in terms of turnout with black and Latino voters. So, you know, he's got a lot of repair work to do among a good size of the electorate in states like that. Again, Glenn, I'm not trying to dodge the question. I don't have any hard data to say, oh, here's a state that he suddenly puts into play. Otherwise, you know, you could come up with theories about any of them and say, well, New Hampshire's the most independent state and he had a big win there, yada, yada. But yet, you know, New Hampshire also, you know, has been, I think we've won it probably 5 out of 6 times.
How about the, well, so his big argument is the Rust Belt path, right? Do you see her, Obama won it by what, 1.2% last time, something like that? She won it in the primary. In 2008, she won the primary. What are you shaking your head for?
The Rust Belt path? I've not heard
that. His whole thing with, like, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, their spiel is that he's advantaged with these white, angry, working class people. Do you buy that as being?
No, he's not. What's the evidence of it? The evidence of it, they've turned out a lot of people. He's not, I think he's broken 50% in only one state, right? You know, Mitt Romney won all those states in his primaries too, probably. I mean, maybe not Pennsylvania. I don't remember where it fell. But that's not dispositive in a general election. He doesn't have a message that appeals to these folks. It's not real. These people need real help in their lives to keep going on the path they're going. And his tax plan, which is a massive giveaway to billionaires and millionaires and corporations, is anathema to them. I mean, you have to have something that you're going to say to people that's going to convince them that you've got, here's a real offer about and a real plan that's going to make your life better, make it worse.
But his intention is to go after her and Bill and Hillary personally. How do you deal with a guy who is just going to batter the hell out of your candidate and your candidate's husband?
Well, you know, look, that's if we get to that campaign and that's how it lines up, we'll have a plan to deal with that.
Well, a couple of other things, I'll let you go. One of the really interesting things about you is you have not had a traditional career trajectory, to say the least, right? You started off
Tell well, me. I started off during when I should have been finishing college and was very close. I was about 12 credits away. I think you and I both went to City University schools, right?
Brooklyn College.
I went to Queens College, which tuition was free at the time I went there.
$750
I was paying $54. They started tuition. Had I finished on time, I never would have had to pay the tuition, but I was 12 credits short, and I was dabbling with some group from college that we started a little theater company and did some...
what was it called?
Avant-garde. I think it was called the Coda Theater Company, C-O-D-A.
And what sort of... When you say avant-garde, this wasn't like an Oak Calcutta kind of thing.
No. But it was not improvisational, but built off some European masters who were working very much in the physical and vocal arena of really stripping down theater to its basic essence with the actor at the center of it, and those performances, no fancy sets, no fancy costumes.
Give me an idea of like a role and a play.
I was on the directing side. There was a play that was actually performed in New York at La Mama and the Cabiculo. It was a one-man show that was pieced together from texts that had been written about the Holocaust, and it was called The Selection.
Oh, interesting.
And it was about one man's journey into the camps, and I wish I had a videotape of it.
So what
the only reason I have any history on it is because my mother saved the newspaper listing of the play in the New York Times and a brief review of it.
Hey, what was it like talking about the Holocaust?
And then went into the beer business because I had an uncle, and I was in Brooklyn, as you know, right? Nice. I had an uncle who was an accountant, and he said, you know, look, there isn't much money in what you're doing here. You got to make some money to live on. And he had been dealing in New York. We have this thing, the C licenses, where you could sell beer and soda, the big warehouses. And he got me and another young guy in business with an older fellow whose brother was retiring, and for 7 years in Crown Heights in Brooklyn.
Crown Heights.
Bedford and Empire, across from the Empire Rollerdrome and around the corner from Ebbets Field.
Wow. My godfather was murdered. He was an Eggman in Fort Greene. That's a really rough, that area was pretty rough when you were there, right?
Well, in fact, one of your colleagues, Roger Simon, who I've known for about 40 years, he and my brother went to college together during the blackout in the 70s when there was a lot of looting, 77 or 77. I ended up sitting in front of my beer store one night during that with a shotgun on my lap that I had borrowed from a girlfriend's brother, because we sat out there all night to protect.
You had an Italian girlfriend, huh?
No, he's Jewish. sat there in that night. And then it really wasn't fulfilling, and, you know, theater obviously kind of tapered off. And, you know, really on a whim, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to be a sports writer covering the New York Yankees and felt
so you were a Yankees fan?
Oh, yeah, big Yankees fan.
Well, Thurman Munson.
You got to remember the first game I went to was 1957.
Wow.
Yogi Berra was playing in left field. Elston Howard was catching. My brother was a Yankees fan.
So you wanted to be a sports writer?
I wanted to write a column. I thought I should be able to write a sports column.
So how'd you get into covering politics?
Well, because I took a couple of journalism classes, the NYU school, news school, et cetera. Roger Simon was actually, I sent Roger a couple of things I typed up on my IBM Selectric, and he was very encouraging. He said, yeah, you could do this. He said, but, you know, one thing, you spelled this word wrong over here. And I said, well, isn't that what editors are for? I was always very political in college. Look, like Bernie Sanders, you know. I got detained during an anti-war rally. We were demonstrating.
Is that true?
Yeah, we went and, you know, shut down the federal building one day up in Albany. We closed down the Long Island Expressway one day after Kent State. It was a lot going on then, you know.
Who did you? You're way too young for McCarthy. Who did you support? Who was the first candidate you actively supported for president?
Bobby Kennedy. I was 16 years old.
Wow.
And supported. I mean, I went out. I came into Manhattan and volunteered. And
did you ever meet him?
Out. No. No. My brother did, and my older brother, who shares office space with me, interned in his office one summer. So I believe he got to meet him there. But I was a great, I remember handing out leaflets then, and it was warm. So, it was shortly before he was assassinated on Fifth Avenue near Central Park.
Don't punt on this. Give me this one. Would a young Joel Benenson have supported Bernie Sanders?
Young Joel Benenson supported. Well, I supported Bobby Kennedy, not Eugene McCarthy, in 68. I mean, that's where I landed. I don't think that was just my brother's influence. I mean, I thought, again, you know, McCarthy was an anti-war candidate. Bobby Kennedy, and with great pleasure, I talk about my son who read The Last Campaign, you know, the great book John Harwood's dad, I believe, right? Or John Harwood's dad has mentioned that he covered it by Thurston Clark. But, you know, he just became enamored of Bobby Kennedy. And I think the same thing was true of us. I think that, you know, I was a junior in high school. My girlfriend was a senior in high school. We had a big event at high school the night Martin Luther King was assassinated. And, you know, he, in Indianapolis, delivers that speech to a crowd of...
Standing
on the hood of a car. Still one of the most eloquent things any candidate has ever done. A guy who spoke to the total injustice that was taking place, not just the war, it was powerful.
And he said, that was the one where he said, I had a brother. Was that the one where he said, I had a brother who was killed too?
Yeah. He quoted Aeschylus. I mean, how many politicians would stand up impromptu and quote Aeschylus?
You should focus group
Aeschylus, right? I mean, it was exquisite, and his aides didn't want him to do it.
And that's what really did it for
him.
And
it was an act of courage. Nobody at that point knew his aides, but it was like an unbelievable moment in a time of pain that spoke to the totality of what we have to do to improve people's lives and make real change in
America.
And
you feel that connection with Hillary in the same way?
I do. I think I've gotten to know her in this campaign. I mean, listen, we ran against her. We ran a hard campaign. We had enormous respect for her during the campaign. It was a hard-fought campaign. She was tough as nails. She is committed. She is a strong believer, and I think getting to know her in this campaign, you know, her motivations come from such a deep place of belief of things she's been fighting for her whole right. life, and not just fighting for them and not just speaking about them, but trying to fix the things, you know? You know, if you think about the quote that, you know, Bobby Kennedy liked, it was about action. It was, you know, it was about changing things that are wrong, taking those actions, getting things done. She doesn't sit back, no matter what it is, you know?
So yeah,
take a look at Flint. It's a great example of this. She didn't just give a speech. She didn't wait. She first sent staff people there to understand from the people on the ground what was wrong, went there, talked to the mayor, figured out what she could do to help. First person to call and encourage them to get federal aid in there, which has made a difference. But that's her approach. And this isn't about just giving the speeches. It's about really figuring out how you can get the things done that will work and that will make people's lives better.
Now, I've written, you know, as you know, I've written some tough stuff about some of the internal stuff in the campaign. Some of it pertained to you about having some connection issues with her early on. Do you feel, it seems to me like being through some of these battles that you do feel like you've gotten to know her better than you did early in the campaign?
Oh, yeah, we have. I mean, we spent a lot of time together during debate prep. You know, she's been on the road more and I'm here more in New York and Brooklyn, I think. But I think we've gotten to know each other more. We talk very frankly. She knows I speak my mind. I'm somebody who does. And I think that works for her. And I think... you know, I bring a certain perspective that I think she values, and I know, you know, I like it when we're doing debate prep, and there's a lot of back and forth, and you're hearing her talk. She's often the one who comes up with the best things because they come from what she's believed for a long time, and I think it's a pretty powerful place to be. I think this is a woman who knows who she is, knows why she's doing this, and the people that she's trying to help.
Do you think there is you've seen all the David Duke stuff, the white supremacist stuff. Do you think there's this, you know, people talk about xenophobia and racism being associated on the other side. Do you think there's a little bit of anti-Semitism too?
I don't know. I know what there is the word I use repeatedly is intolerance. I mean, look, I worked at the New York Daily News with Serge Kovalevsky.
Yeah.
You know, and to have a presidential candidate stand up and mock a person who has a disability and again, and Serge, anybody who knows him, he is a wonderful person. He is a great journalist. And to see that happen, it's a disgrace. And I think that level of intolerance, whether we're talking about the language the other day about Muslims hate America, look, you know, there's no question that there in the Muslim world are, you know, terrorist groups that are not representative of all Muslims, probably. I just think when you engage in that kind of intolerance, you are tearing America down, not building America up. We are a country of values. You know, I think the other night, even a point of difference between Senator Sanders and Senator Clinton, I mean, calling Castro's revolution a revolution of values and defending it again in a full-throated way, that's not true for millions of Latinos who have come to America from many places in addition to Cuba, who escaped oppressive revolutionary dictators. I think that people have to be careful with the words they choose, and not for political purposes, but because you can either reinforce American values when you're a politician, or you can undermine them.
We should call this not off message, but last question, because I tend to ask about 10 of them. But here's the one that just popped into my head. My colleague Annie Carney wrote, I think, a kind of a fun story about David Axelrod, your former colleague, who has been getting on Twitter and CNN and saying whatever the hell pops into his head. Have you talked with him about any of this stuff? Like,
You know, here's the deal. Ax and I joke with people that during the campaigns, we probably talk to each other five times a day. We probably talk to each other, you know, still. It certainly isn't five times a day, but, you know, it's probably been a day and a half since we've actually spoken on the phone. But I did happen to call him this morning, and it went to voicemail. I mean, we talk all the time.
What'd you say on the voicemail?
I said, give me a call. Oh, no, it goes straight to voicemail. You can't leave a message. Okay. So I got to email him, and then you showed up, so... I've got to email him, but no, he'll see I called. He'll
Do you tell him? Are you like, can it, dude?
No, look, David is where we disagree. I tell him why we disagree. I tell him where if he said something I think is illegitimate, I tell him why I think it's illegitimate, and he'll tell me why he thinks it's legitimate. You know, we both are straight with each other all the time.
He's not pissing you off.
I mean, look, there are times, look, I tweeted something the other day, and he emailed me back suggesting that maybe there was something he said that I didn't like so much. I mean, but it's not personal. I mean, we're very close friends. We're always going to be. We've been through some great battles together. He knows my strengths. He knows my weaknesses. I know his, and we listen to each other because we have enormous respect. I mean, you've probably heard me say this. You know, my wife has often called him my brother from another mother because, we would talk so much regularly. And I certainly miss not talking to him five times a day. But there's no problem when we go back and forth a bit.
Well, Joel, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you, Glenn.